Thank you, Emma, and thank you to the British Animal Studies Network for inviting me to give this talk. It was my idea to make it into a public lecture because basically that's what I do nowadays. I don't very often talk to fellow academics. I tend to talk more to the general and pet-owning public because I felt that towards the end of my research career, we were all doing all sorts of exciting things in animal welfare, but that we were essentially only talking to each other, and that most of the information wasn't actually getting out to the millions of pet owners in this country and tens of millions worldwide who could actually best implement all of this stuff. So for the past 7 or 8 years, I've spent almost all of my time talking to the public, writing books, doing the occasional television programme when they have me on to try and get these kinds of messages across. But all the way through that time, I have been interested in a kind of fundamental question, one of the fundamental questions of anthrozoology being this general study of human-animal interactions. And that general question is, why do we have animals in our houses? And I'll just put it as simply and as plainly as that. What on earth are we doing having animals in our houses? And I'm guessing most of the people who've come here tonight have some kind of animal at home, maybe quite a lot of animals at home. So, what is this all about? What is the purpose behind it? Why do we carry on doing it when it's plainly not functional anymore? We don't need these animals about, most of us anyway, don't need these animals to go about our everyday lives. Why do we need them? We seem to need them emotionally. What does that mean? Why do we need them emotionally? Why can't we just reserve our emotions for members of our own species? And I think some of these issues go much wider than simply pet keeping. I think they have their ramifications in more general aspects of animal welfare, the sort of things we've been talking about this afternoon and tomorrow in the meeting, and indeed into our whole relationship with the natural world, and animals in particular, but then of course animals have to live somewhere. So I think this does extend out into a whole concern for the planet and what we're doing to it and what we might do or not do to it in the future. So I'm not just going to talk about cute kittens and cuddly animals, although they will, of course, as if you've been to one of my talks before, you'll know they do crop up. So despite the fact that we don't really need animals, or most of us don't need animals in our everyday lives anymore, pet keeping is increasing in popularity. Spending in the United States is double in real terms what it was 30 years ago. People spend $7 billion a year on personal animals in this country, and almost half of that is on some kind of service. So it might be somebody to walk your dog, it might be a pet sitter, but a lot of it is on veterinary services. And the people who like to make money out of these things, this has not passed them by. So this is a guy who simply advises investors in the United States, and he thinks that the humanization of pets is one of the greatest investment opportunities that you can make today, because people are not just, there's a limit to what people will spend on dog food, but there doesn't seem to be much of a limit as to what they will spend, if they have the money anyway, on other things for their dog, expensive and complicated and sophisticated veterinary services, someone to talk to the dog all day while they're out at work earning the money to pay for the dog. Those kinds of things are a massive growth area in economics. So rather than giving up the idea of keeping animals around us because we don't need them anymore, we seem to be taking them ever more seriously, at least in terms of economics. We haven't really changed the animals very much in the process of doing this. It hasn't been going on for very long. Obviously, we're really only talking about half a century or so. But at least in a widespread terms. So we've borrowed animals from from our previous lives as farmers and turned them into companions. And rather than use the obvious examples of dogs and cats, which are, I'm sure you can imagine anyway, I've chosen the example of pigs. So we've had pigs in our lives for a very, very long time, many thousands of years. Whether any of those were ever pets in Europe, we don't really know. We know there were pets in other parts of the world, as I'll come on to. And now, by breeding smaller pigs that you can kind of drape over your shoulder and carry onto an aeroplane, we have developed the idea of the emotional support pig, which is what this particular beast is supposed to be. The The pig and its owner were kicked off the aeroplane because of an unfortunate defecatory incident. But nevertheless, that she got onto the aeroplane through the necessary checks on the grounds that this was an emotional support animal. So, we've changed the relationship. We haven't perhaps changed the animals as much as we've changed the way we think about them. Now, there are people around who, they don't shout very loudly these days, but there certainly is a point of view that all these animals are just parasites. And if I was a hard-headed, old-fashioned biologist, I'd say, well, of course they are. That's what they are. They're just taking us for a ride. They're getting us just to provide them with very comfortable surroundings and tasty food, and they give us absolutely nothing back whatsoever. Everything, all the rewards we get from them are totally imaginary. Some commentators go so far as to say they're actually suppressing human reproduction, that couples unable to afford, perhaps, or wishing to delay to have children are having pets instead. There are other explanations. There is a phenomenon of sorts, but there are other explanations for that, which I'm not going to go into. And in any case, the demographics tell us that in both this country and most of the Western world, most pets are owned by families with children. If this was a real trend, then I think we'd see a shift in the types of people owning pets, and we don't. Now, I want to start off very quickly. Again, some of you will think that I've come to tell you that pets will heal all your ills and animal therapy is a wonderful thing, unless you read The Independent last week when I published an article saying that pet therapy is under-researched, shall we say, in terms of how it works. But I'm not going to talk about that. But I do want to just dispel a couple of the standard myths about pet keeping, which people use to justify doing it, although I don't think it justifies why we do it and why we've continued to do it. And this is based on research that was done back in the late 1980s, which apparently showed that pet owners survived heart attacks better than people who didn't have pets. Well, it did show that. But what was cause and what was effect was much less clear, although it seemed to be clear at the time. And the supposed mechanism behind this was that pets reduce your stress. They make you feel better. They make you less stressed. Stress is known to affect your cardiovascular health in a bad way. So, yes, that's obviously what's going on. And people did lots of research into what actually goes on when people interact with nice, friendly, cuddly animals. And they got people stroking dogs and measured the hormone levels in their blood and so on, and showed that there was a release of oxytocin, which at the time was thought to be the love hormone. There's, again, quite a lot of doubt cast on really what it is over the last few years. But it seemed this was kind of sewn up, and that all you had to do was get yourself a kitten and stroke it a lot, and you'd live forever. But when people started looking at the actual statistics behind this, they found that pet owners actually don't live any longer than people who don't have pets. So that kind of started to cast a cloud over the whole thing. Not that some of the more enthusiastic proponents of this idea took much notice. I think if in reality, again, most of you, I'm guessing, have animals at home, you'll know that sometimes your pets reduce your stress and make you happy, and other times you get completely annoyed by them. I was going to say something ruder there. So it's ups and downs. I mean, there are lots of things about keeping pets, quite apart from the amount of money it costs, which you could, if you didn't have to do that extra bit of work, you could relax by a pool with a book. Maybe that would make you live longer too. But there are negative things, psychologically negative things, about having pets. You have to do things like this nowadays. That wasn't part of dog keeping when I grew up. Nowadays, you have to go and scoop. The old saying about, who's the man coming down from Mars and wondering who's the dog and who's the master here. I have this man behind me on the end of a piece of string who picks up my poop. So this is not necessarily a thing that dog owners enjoy, although they still seem to do it. An insurance company did a survey, which at least wasn't a very scientific one, but it showed apparently that pets cause vast numbers of arguments. There are lots of couples who are actually divided by their pet. One person is very fond of the pet, the other one really thinks it's a nuisance, and people have lots of arguments about them. And of course, there is the inevitability that because their lifespans are shorter than ours, they die several times. If you have a succession of pets, you will have several pet deaths to cope with during the course of your life. And there is, these are genuinely distressing events, and people who study grief and provide grief counselling for pet owners have shown this is genuine. This is not just mawkish sentimentality. This is a genuine loss of what appears to be a member of your family. So it's not all benefits. It's losses as well. And maybe those two things cancel out. However, recently, some people have analysed very large data sets in America and shown what seems to be the real relationship. So it's not that pets make you healthy. It's that healthy people acquire pets. And unhealthy people with not very much money and who have to move around all the time looking for work don't get pets because it's just not convenient. And that produces this association between pet keeping and long life. In fact, if you are the sort of person who has the right kind of luck and the right kind of money, then you will tend to live longer because that you will be able to live a healthy lifestyle, and as part of that lifestyle you'll be able to get a pet. But there really isn't any much, very much of a connection between the pet and the healthy lifestyle. And in any case, this is not an evolutionary explanation for pet keeping. It can't explain really why we used to keep pets and still do. It just acts as a kind of propaganda, if you like, for those people who think we should keep pets. And the second myth I just want to dispel, just in case you've got a pet because you thought your kids would be grow up to be much better people. Again, the same group of people in California looking with a different data set have discovered that this, again, is the same relationship, basically. The claims were that pets improve children's social skills and self-esteem and cognitive development, and they make them all around just nicer people, much more empathetic, although there's actually very little data to support that. In fact, most of the data says that empathy with people and empathy with animals are unrelated. They don't cancel one another out. Some people are empathetic towards both, some towards one, some towards the other. There's no real relationship between the two. There is a notable exception to this. Before you think I'm just dissing every kind of animal-assisted therapy and so on, there was going to be the role of pets in particularly children with autism has been very well documented, and it's been shown that not all of these children, but many of these children on the autism spectrum, can form very good social relationships with animals and use those animals as a bridge to communicate with people. So that kind of animal-assisted therapy, I think, is well-founded and well worth pursuing. But, as I said, the real explanation for why children who come from families who have pets are more outgoing and more sociable and do better at school is that it's back to the parents. It's back to the parents being in a position to have pets because they don't have to move around all the time, so the kids can go to the same school all the way through. They live in a house with a garden where the children can play and all those sorts of things. The association is just correlation. It's not cause and effect. However, and this is where I'm going to return to this towards the end, pets are very valuable as models for biology, and I think this is something which has been underemphasized in going for the idea that pets are going to make your kids better people. I think the real message, the one that is actually proved by research, is that having animals around makes your children understand animals. It should be blindingly obvious, but with the reduction in the amount of biological science that's taught in schools, I think this is a really important thing for people to learn because, as I'll come on to later, an empathy for animals turns into other things which I think are beneficial to mankind in general. So what is pet keeping? For the rest of this talk, I'm going to really give you a set of speculations, hypotheses, if you like, drawn from the science of evolutionary psychology. If you think that's just a lot of gobbledygook, let me just explain very briefly what evolutionary psychology says. Evolutionary psychology says that our brains are biological. They're not something we constructed ourselves from Lego. They evolved over many millions of years through lots of different kinds of animals, into primates and then into our own species. They've changed and obviously become much more sophisticated as we have evolved and changed. And many of the things that we do today can be explained not by the kinds of environments we live in today, but by the kinds of environments that we did most of our evolving in. The arguments really are around how long ago you should take that. But we did most of our evolving in a situation where we had stone tools and moved around a lot, had no agriculture, no pets, no animals, no domestic animals at all. And so whatever we do now is, many of the things we do now have at least hangovers from all of that. Our sweet tooth, for example, which is causing such an epidemic of obesity in the West, is characterised as something which benefited our ancestors in the past because they would seek out the very rare sweet foods they could find, which would give them energy to run away from saber-toothed tigers. I put that slightly glibly, but you get the general idea. But I'm not going to give you a primer on evolutionary psychology. There may be even some evolutionary psychologists here who could do that much better than I can. The important point that I want to make is that when the anthropologists went around the world, or at least early Victorian explorers initially, not scientists at all, went around the world discovering societies that were still living in the Stone Age, and I'm going to use that extremely glibly, and I hope you'll forgive me for that, they found that many of those societies, not all of them, but a very high proportion, had pets of some kind. Some of those pets were animals that you'd expect. So some of them had acquired dogs through trading, even before they were, in inverted commas, discovered. But most of the pets, even in those societies, were wild animals. So animals that had been caught in the wild and brought back and looked after almost as members of the family. Now, you can see that the picture I've got here is a modern one. Plastic shoes were not around in the Stone Age. But this is a sloth, the animal, and it's been captured as a young animal, much smaller than that. It's kind of growing to the stage where it might be let back in the wild fairly soon, I suspect. But this kind of thing went on all over the place, in many parts of the world, in Papua New Guinea, in Amazonia, in Siberia, in Alaska, all sorts of societies having taken their local animals and adopted them as pets. Sometimes the relationships were complex. So in this example from New Guinea, that pig is actually in transition between being a pet. The women and children sitting on the platform behind have looked after that pig since it was a tiny piglet and looked after it very well. But periodically in this particular culture, these piglets, once they get to be large, are taken away by the men and there's a ritual feast. So there's a kind of move between being a pet for most of your life and being a meal for the last few minutes. But nevertheless, up to that point, these animals were pets. Now, I meant to do this at the beginning. Okay, so there are some... I'm a biologist, so I tend to occasionally show pictures which might make you feel a bit squeamish. So I'm going to give a little warning when I'm about to show one of the pictures. So I'm about to show one of those pictures now. It's not the worst one, but if you want to look away, do. But, if you can block your ears as well if you want to, I'll wave when I've finished. One of the characteristics that's been made a great deal of these societies is that they breastfed many of these animals. This is a lady from north of Japan doing the traditional thing of breastfeeding a bear cub, where the bear cubs were taken from the mother as she came out of hibernation and then raised. And as in the other example I gave, eventually the bears were sacrificed mainly by the men. And the women were very upset about it. But this was part of their culture. People have made a great deal of this because it's such an intimate relationship. And it implies a great deal of intimacy. It almost certainly does, but it isn't an integral part of it, because when societies that by that time had milk-producing animals, so goats or sheep or cattle or whatever, they still did this collecting animals from the wild thing to make pets, but they didn't breastfeed them. So it's clearly something that's more kind of nutritional and necessary than cultural, in the sense of being an essential part of pet keeping. Thank goodness, otherwise we probably wouldn't do it today. Okay, finished. Funny bit finished. So what happened during the course of our evolution? Well, we obviously all of us only have indirect information about this. I'm following a set of ideas proposed by the archaeologist Stephen Mithen at Reading University. this is all speculation, we can't wind the clock back 50,000 years, but what he proposed was that about that time, there was a change in the way that our brain's architecture was organized. So previously, we'd had bits of our brain which were to do with tools and parts that were to do with animals. Our ancestors almost certainly knew a lot about the animals around them, otherwise they wouldn't have been able to hunt them. We had a lot of knowledge and a lot of ways of dealing with other people, and that's, as you may know, one of the ideas behind the drivers for our enormous brain compared to that of other primates, that it's to do with social, coping with social situations. And by that time, we had language almost certainly as well. But that these things tended to operate somewhat independently of one another at around 50,000 years ago, and it's a guess, and the timing is about changes in technologies, not about anything to do with animals, so I'm not going to go into all the evidence for it. Those things began to merge, and we began to think like animals, or think, put ourselves into the places of animals in a way that we hadn't done, or their ancestors hadn't done before. So we had a theory of animal mind. So rather than just simply regarding animals as something you go out and throw a spear at, and if you're lucky, you can eat, we started thinking of them as beings, a sort of human. We also extended this to lots of other areas, superstition, and giving rise to primitive religions. The whole business of starting to think that other things other than each other have minds has all sorts of ramifications. And it's referred to by the tongue-twisting name of anthropomorphism. The picture on the right there is one of the earliest examples we've got of evidence for this change. It's one of the first zoomorphic figures. So this is you've got a lion's head and a human body. It actually was originally carved out of a single mammoth tusk. It fell apart, which is why it's had to be reconstructed like that. But it shows in this is the first, I think the earliest, or one of the best early examples anyway, of people being able to think that animals and humans have some sort of continuity between them. They might have similar minds, and therefore you can actually fuse them together. You can have a human with a lion's head, or you can have a human head on an animal body. That isn't ridiculous. It's actually telling you something about the way the world is. And the important thing the change in our mentality was that it enabled us to be much more sophisticated hunters. There were lots of interesting things around to hunt, as obviously there were mammoths, because that figurine was carved from a mammoth tusk. Lots of big mammals which gave you massive amounts of meat, the tusks, bones for doing all sorts of things with hides, very productive way of living. And so we may imagine that this made our ancestors much more prolific and much more efficient hunters, and therefore much more successful. And there's one theory is that Neanderthals died out because they weren't as good at doing these things as our ancestors, sapiens. There is also another side to this story, which perhaps doesn't get the same attention, was that, of course, we were also potentially prey. We're two-legged. We can't run very... We were running on two legs by that time, not very fast. There were lots of lions around. This is actually Ice Age Spain, and it's obviously an artistic depiction, but there's a couple of cave lions there. We like to live in caves too at that time. So I suspect that outthinking a lion was probably just as useful to one's lifespan as outthinking a mammoth, because a mammoth will feed you for a week. Outthinking a lion might enable you to live long enough to have some children. So thinking about animals as if they were human gave our ancestors an advantage. Although, of course, it's a wild inaccuracy. It's good enough. It was good enough to them, for them then, and it was better than what other hominid species had, probably. Okay, so that's change number one. Then we must have had some sort of change in our cute response. The cute response is the gooey feeling you get when you look at a baby. And goodness knows when it evolved, because pretty much all mammals look after their young. There are some exceptions, but it's certainly a long time before there were any primates, certainly a very long time before there were any humans. And so the detractors of pet keeping say, oh, look, come on, this is just, kittens are just convincing you that they're little babies and distracting you from looking after your own children. I don't think you do, actually. There's no evidence for that, but it's what people say. Because they push all the buttons. You know, they don't just have baby-like faces. They play, which is very cute, and they do all of those things. It looks as though if that was true 50,000 years ago, we fairly rapidly evolved a way around that. Now, the cue response has been studied now quite extensively in brain scans and all sorts of things. And there are vast numbers of areas of the brain which are activated by pictures of human babies that are not activated by pictures of human adults, for example, as the next sort of nearest control. And there are loads of them on there, and don't worry about it. Just take in the sheer number of them and the number of things they do. They elicit emotional responses. They make us want to approach them. We start thinking about children. We see their faces and make sure that, you know, if the baby's the wrong way up, then we still know it's a baby. There's some very basic sort of perception things. We find that looking at pictures of babies is rewarding. We want to do things for them. It immediately has effects on our behavior. And that this involves all sorts of different parts of the brain. Kittens, not so much. It's all the same bar about six areas, the ones that are just coming up in red. They're not activated by pictures of puppies and kittens, and they are activated by human babies. And although I don't want to bore you with more pictures of the brain, because they send me to sleep too, but there are other parts of the brain which react only to animals and not to humans at all. So our brains evolved in a number of different ways to enable us to exploit animals and hopefully to prevent animals, little baby animals, from exploiting us any more than they needed to. So those things still trigger caregiving. People want to look after, they get reward from looking after their animals. And it's, although it's tempting to say this is all cultural, that we all, we learn it because it's accepted part of behavior in Western society. There have been a number of studies, very few has to be said, that tend to suggest that this is actually something really quite instinctive as far as we're concerned. This was an unrepeatable study, I think, done in an orphanage in Germany not long after World War II. The children who were taken out and they were exposed to animals of various kinds by a biologist who just wanted to know what children who'd never seen an animal before and had lived in very restricted surroundings would make of animals. So he gave them all sorts of things to play with, snakes, spiders. And then he noted that when they were offered young cats, they did this instinctive thing. Even the boys picked them up and cradled them like babies. So I think this is probably something which is, at least in Caucasians anyway, embedded in human nature. And caregiving is actually rewarding in itself. Again, I'm not going to do the science. The example is the Tamagotchi, which I should convince everybody. Just looking after something is not just peer pressure. People genuinely enjoy looking after these things. Although, of course, the precise form of this depends on a great deal on culture. So, where do we get all this stuff from? Why did we evolve it? I think I've shown a little bit about why we might have done it, but how we might have done it, but why we might have done it. Well, the first thing is this, going back to this oxytocin reaction to stroking animals' fur. Actually, there are other hormones released which haven't received the press that oxytocin has, because oxytocin is a love hormone, isn't it? And beta endorphin is equivalent to heroin, so that's bad. But of course it isn't. Beta endorphin is a very rewarding substance. When it's so stroking an animal, you get a beta endorphin release. It's going to make you feel good, and it's going to make you want to do it again. And where does this come from? Well, I think, and that's, you know, this is what part of the book is about, is that we had to give up grooming one another when we became humans. Now, for 8 million years, roughly, as far as we can tell anyway, primates have been bonding together by grooming one another, by running their fingers through the other one's fur, looking for parasites and stuff as well. But the amount of time they spend doing it is in great disproportion to the amount of hygiene that it produces. It has an acute social significance. Who grooms who is a very good predictor of who likes who and who doesn't like who. when we became hairless, and there's a lot of argument about when that happened, that kind of became useless. But I suspect we've actually kept this somewhere buried deep in our brains. And so stroking animals is actually, that's the reason why it's rewarding. I mean, why is it rewarding? Why on earth is it? Stroking teddy bear fur is rewarding. People have shown that, you know. It doesn't even have to be a living animal. There's something about this which we respond to in a very basic way. So, there is still an argument to be made that pet keeping is useless. But I'm going to make it now in terms of 50,000 years ago. Okay, so our ancestors started keeping pets as long ago as that, since they started seeing animals as little people or something like a little person that could trigger pet keeping, collecting animals out of the wild, not just munching them up, but bringing them back and looking after them almost as if they were human. Why didn't this die out? Because it's not actually a terribly good idea, biologically speaking. These animals eat stuff which we might otherwise be able to eat. It's probably not a coincidence that many of these species, dog, cat, and pig, are classic examples, started out probably as scavengers rather than as us feeding them directly. But after a while, we had to start providing them, all of those, with food to some extent, at least. But I think the main reason why it's not a good idea to go collecting nasty, smelly, diseased animals from the wild is that they are full of diseases which we can catch ourselves, so-called zoonoses. One of the classic examples from the modern era is the guaha in Amazonia, who dote on little monkeys that they catch in the wild. The little monkeys are great reservoirs of TB and various other diseases which are common to most primates. And so the missionaries who discovered these tribes and then subsequently the medical support they've had, they have to make absolutely sure they're up to date with their TB shots, otherwise their monkeys would kill them. So, not directly, obviously. So, if you believe in a kind of strictly evolutionary point of view, this should have died out. We should have selected against this. We should have said, no, this is a waste of time. We're making ourselves sick, or at least we might not have even been aware of it. But tribes who developed a culture of doing this would have died out, whereas tribes which just said, okay, animals are out there, we want to outsmart them, but let's just eat them. Let's not bring them home. Those would have done better. In fact, we seem to, as far as we can tell, the opposite happened. How on earth did the opposite happen? Well, I've got three ideas about this. Then the first one is speculative, but it explains a piece of modern behaviour, which is otherwise, I think, ridiculously inexplicable. And that is that people who were good with animals were selected as marriage partners. So it's actually a form for the Darwinists here, it's a form of sexual selection. That showing that you can look after animals, which are the tribes, the group, the family's pets, or whatever you want to call them, it shows that you are actually a kind, caring person. And that would be true of women, possibly, but of course, in those sorts of societies, teenage girls look after the young ones. Even the in-laws, who would have been doing the picking, incidentally, this is not the era of romantic love, don't forget, it's the in-laws who make the choices about who marries who, they would have been able to see directly. So that's why I think the real effect you see today is on men. Men are so much more trustworthy if they have a dog beside them or a cat. And this has been shown in a variety of different experiments done in different continents, in different completely different methodologies. This is the one I like particularly. This was done in France, of course. So apologies to those French people who are here. This is the experimental setup is this guy is in a park near a shopping area where there are lots of attractive young women going by. And he's given a script, which he has to memorize, and he said, I want you to chat up every pretty girl within a certain roughly age range that goes past you. Here are your lines, which you have to deliver the same to make sure it's a good experiment. And half the time you're going to have this cute little dog with you. It was actually a Labrador, not a terrier. And the other half of the time, you're not. And he got one third of the telephone numbers when he had the dog and less than 10% when he didn't. And there have been all sorts of other experiments that have shown similar things. Even men who are described as really quite unreliable suddenly become more appealing on dating websites if you just add the phrase, and he has a dog. And people react to women react to them much, much more positively that way. So I think this is a very odd piece of behaviour, and I think it's actually part of the way that animal-assisted therapy works. I don't think the animals are magic. I think the animals confer magic on the person handling them, that the person handling them is much more approachable. And so the therapist, who is actually the person, not the animal at all, gains access to the other person's confidence much more quickly. But I think the major effect, actually, that's a little bit speculative. I think the major factor is domestication of animals, which is something I've been interested in for a very long time. And one of the things I've never been able to understand, particularly now that the DNA evidence is there, it shows that domestication happened very early on. I mean, the cat was thought to have been domesticated 5,000 years ago. It's gone back to 10,000. Dog, maybe 14,000. Some people now say it's 30,000. The pig, equally, are going back a lot further. How on earth did we manage to domesticate animals when most of us were nomadic. We had no fences. We had no fixed houses, certainly no barbed wire or anything like that. How do we manage to stop the animals that we've managed to tame and start to breed in our establishments, even if they were pets? How are we going to stop them from going on out into the wild? How are we going to stop wild animals from coming in? And I think the only way we could have done that is if those animals were not commodities, because it takes many, many generations. It takes hundreds of years to generate a domestic animal, even under laboratory conditions. There's an experiment done in Russia with fur foxes. It took them 50 generations to turn a wild fur fox, which was already adapted to living in a cage, into something that you could handle. How much? And that's with the full force of the Russian government and their money behind them. How much longer must it have taken our Stone Age forebears to have done this? So how did we do it? How did we stop these animals from breeding with the animals outside, which were their wild relatives? How did we manage to turn those into domestic animals? And I think the answer is that they were pets, because we know now that societies with domestic animals outcompeted those with none. That seems to have been the theme that went on. The dog was the first animal to be domesticated, and people hunting with dogs were responsible for some major extinctions. Sometimes this is slightly overclaimed, but there are certainly some extinctions, particularly those in America, which coincide exactly with the arrival of people hunting with dogs on the continent. And it's hard to believe that dogs didn't play a part in it. So maybe we just outcompeted those people who had dogs. And could handle them and knew how to deal with them and knew how to use them in hunting were very competitive compared to people who hadn't. And how did we keep them separate? Well, I think if you just treat an animal as a commodity, I don't think you'll do either of these things. But I think if you treat the animal as a personal animal, a part of your family, literally a part of the family and physically, you do two things. One is you protect the genes that you've selected for tameness. And you've got to go on doing this for hundreds of years for anything to actually happen. So that speaks to a culture which is going to have a long tradition of keeping animals separate as personal animals, rather than letting them go out and mate with wild wolves or cats or pigs or whatever. And the second thing it'll do is when a little bit of ice age comes along and you're absolutely starving, hungry, and you can't hunt or gather because there's nothing to hunt or gather, you must be tempted to eat whatever animals you've domesticated or part domesticated. And the only barrier I can see to doing that is if those animals are actually almost human. And therefore, it's like cannibalism. It's like eating your relatives to survive a famine. And so I think that, again, if they're just commodities, then why not eat them? And then you're back to square one. Well, except, of course, people didn't know they were back to square one, because at that point they didn't understand the process. Now, I'm conscious that, particularly in the conference, we're talking to there are a lot of social scientists there, so I'm going to talk a very little bit about variation in pet keeping and how this is all cultural, but I'm going to do some more genetics in about 2 minutes, so brace yourselves. So the detail of pet keeping in the West, and probably everywhere, is cultural. Okay, so this is work done by my friend Hal Herzog in America, who traced American Kennel Club registrations and related them back to movie star animals. The effect petered out in the 80s, but between the 1950s and the 1970s, basically every time there was a popular movie, this one is called The Shaggy Dog. I don't remember seeing it. I think it was only popular over there. It starred an old English sheepdog. Registrations of old English sheepdogs went through the roof and then took about 10 years to tail off. And he's got hundreds of these graphs. Well, not hundreds, dozens of these graphs showing the same sort of effect. So there are massive cultural effects on doing this, on what kind of pets people have. And of course, there are differences between cultures as well. The Japanese have a traditional set of dogs, breeds, which, to be fair, have been displaced by the so-called colonization of dog breeding, like everything else in Japan. They now want Western dogs. But of course, cultures still are divided, and there is still a lot of cultural variation. So again, this is the worst slide of the lot. So look away if you don't like to see this, which is just over the sea in northern China, is a dog butcher happily cutting up dogs for meat. So we're not talking about anything particularly universal in terms of what animals people think should be pets and what they think shouldn't be pets. There are huge cultural variations. So I'm not just talking about dogs and cats. Okay, it's safe to look again now. But we know even in the West that the numbers of pets and the popularity of pets varies a lot. And it seems to run in families. That was well established back in the late 1980s by James Serple. More recently, it's been discovered that that's associated. Pet-keeping families have more empathy for animals. They're more likely to go to zoos. They're more likely to join the RSPCA. They're more likely to give money to the World Wildlife Fund, whatever. So there's a general trend there. And some work I actually did here, Emma referred to my time at Southampton University. This was a joint project between ourselves and a Japanese university. We actually surveyed students in these very lecture theatres to see what they were studying and whether they'd had pets in their childhood. And even the degree course that 18-year-olds, well, actually they're probably a bit older, about 20-year-olds were doing, seems to have been related back to the animals, to the number of animals their parents had had. So the more animals your parents had in your household when you were a child, the more likely you are to be doing biological science and the less likely you are to be doing management or economics. So it had some. There were some fairly profound variations here. And at the time, we and everybody else thought these were cultural. Until a couple of years ago, the first twin study emerged on this. I'm running out of time, so I won't go into the great details of how twin studies work, but they are a way of discovering. There are arguments about exactly how to do them, but they are a well-established way of discovering how much of variation in behaviour between people is genetic and how much is environmental. And if you survey people when they're older, you can also discover how much was their parents' environment and how much was the things they've encountered since they left home. And so this was really about just a very simple bit of a survey of twins that had served in the Vietnam War, as it happened to be, because they're being followed up. They have been followed up ever since. So they're now, or when the survey was done, they were in their 50s. They were all male, mostly Caucasians. And the surprising result, the one that rocked anthrozoology on its heels, or it would have done if it had been better publicised anyway, was that their childhood experience, which we all thought was the major thing that had turned them into pet lovers, contributed less than 5% of their choices when they were 50 years old. There was a quite strong genetic influence. About one third of their choices were it's about one third genetic influenced, and two thirds what had happened to them during their lives since they left home. Just to those of you who are not used to these numbers, and I certainly wasn't until I started looking at this. These are the equivalent figures for very generalised for human personality, not animal personality. Your personality, 5% childhood experience. 55% your experiences since you left home and 40% genetics. So comparable in terms of the numbers. So this is something which is not about family traditions, although some of the detail, in fact, probably most of the detail probably is. People who grew up with dogs tend to have dogs. People who grew up with cats tend to have cats. But whether they have either, it seems to be largely determined by genetics and then things that have happened to them since they left home. So my conclusion then is that pet keeping is an evolved trait. It is not a hangover from some bucolic agricultural past that we used to have and we can't give up Just like, you know, we like to have bowls of potpourri around our houses with leaves and stuff in. We like to bring nature in. No, this is not about that. This is a universal or nearly universal trait. We don't, most of the studies, as in most psychology, have not, you know, have not been done in Africa, for example. But as far as we can tell, at least within the West, it's nearly universal. There is a lot of cultural variation, of course, and I hopefully I've literally graphically demonstrated that. But there is variation within cultures. We don't know about between cultures. No one's ever studied it. But within cultures, we think there is now, we now think there is some of it, a lot of it's cultural, but there is a genetic basis for it. And the two things it allows us to do in terms of our more ancient behaviour is it allows us to express two things which used to be really useful to us in the past. They may not be useful to us now, but they were useful to us 20, 30,000 years ago. And one of them is the grooming thing, which was useful to us when we were monkeys, basically. And the other one is looking after animals, which may not be hugely productive now, but would probably enabled our ancestors to survive when those around them who didn't like animals and didn't think animals were people perished. And recent research done in Canada, as well, in addition to the, what I've already described, has really linked this empathy for keeping animals in your home to empathy for animals out there in the wild. There are lots of kind of battles going on about pet keeping. People saying, oh, cats kill too many wildlife. People say dogs shouldn't bite people and regard them, you know, well, to kill them if they do. There's all sorts of tensions going on between these animals, people who like these animals and people who don't. And particularly in terms of wildlife, that what this research suggests is that empathy for animals is a general trait, and it embraces not just pets, although that's an outward expression of it. It embraces all kinds of other animals, and respect for the wild, respect for conservation of wild places where animals can live. And so I think, basically, if we don't respect this, if we do try and to stamp it out, we're actually shooting ourselves in the foot. I think pet keeping, although, yeah, you may not agree with me, is actually at the heart of conservation. Thank you very much.